First of all, good morning to everybody. Thank you for being here this morning for what is really a special meeting of the Fisheries Work Group. And before we get started, I would like to explain a couple things about the Fisheries Work Group itself. For some of you, I haven't seen at Fisheries Work Group meetings yet, and I'm probably not really familiar with to the extent they probably need to be to what we do and who we are, and then explain what we hope to accomplish this morning. And then we'll go from there. So we're the Fisheries Work Group, which is a joint work group of the borough and city. So we're here as advisory members for the city and the borough. And we've been in existence for over 5 years, listening to various fisheries issues. And if you can imagine, the last 4 or 5 years, focus has always been on trawl bycatch issues and groundfish issues. So that's obviously been parked at the most recent North Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting, and there's been some really pertinent other fisheries, and particularly salmon issues, that have come to the forefront. So we're able and actually need to address those issues. But our role is to listen to the public, to learn the issues, and then to make advisory recommendations to our respective bodies. So our hope today, and I can appreciate everybody being here, our hope today was that we can hear from you, we can hear from industry experts and state representatives, and we have some biologists and possibly some on the line, and that we can learn as an advisory group. We can learn everything we need to know to the extent we can in a two-hour meeting about this issue, and this is obviously the genetic study issue, and then how we can address it. Our goal is to have takeaways, is to have bullet points and talking points that we can ultimately, if that's the direction of the group, is to recommend as either a letter to the Board of Fish, and also to give us talking points that we could testify to the issue at the Board of Fish. So we're here to listen. We're here to learn. And I don't want anybody's expectations to be too high that, that we're going to solve any problems today or even tomorrow. But we're here to, as elected officials, to learn about the issues, the extent we can, and make sure that we as a community are represented at the Board of Fish meeting. So that's the goal. And the last thing I just wanted to say is that typically we don't meet in here. We meet downstairs. It's a little bit more informal. So I don't want anybody to feel intimidated. If you want to speak today and you come up to the microphone, We're not intimidating. We're just here to listen. So hopefully you'll feel comfortable. And when we get to public comment, which will be next, we'll have two opportunities for public comment, one at the beginning and one at the end of the meeting. So you'll have 3 minutes to speak if you'd like to speak. And we'll get started in just 1 second. And for those that are listening on KMXT that do wish to call in, there's a toll-free number, which is 855-492-9202. Or the local number is 486-3231. So at this point, we'll take public comments. So if you'd like to speak, please come forward and state your name for the record, and then push the red button for the microphone. You've got 3 minutes.
Now it's on. My name is Chris Burns. I'm a resident of Kodiak and a fisherman, a salmon fisherman. I just want this issue is this Cook Inlet issue has been around since the 60s. They've been trying to curtail our harvest of fishery, and it came to a head in the late 80s. We went two board meetings. They put a bunch of restrictions on what we were doing in the fisheries here on Kodiak. And then right after the 93 cycle board meeting went, soon after that, the Cook Inlet guys came in with a same deal like they're doing now, exactly the same thing. Conservation emergency based on a prediction, based upon, at that time, it was a high harvest. They had like a 7 or an 8 million run, which is a huge run for them, and we caught a few of their fish. And anyhow, and then we went, so the city and the borough formed a work group. We battled them out till the next cycle. I think the Cook Inlet Kodiak work group with two board fish members on it had meetings for a couple of years, and we went to the final, the 96 Board of Fish meeting, and basically we beat Cook Cook Inlet off again. They wanted to close the South Mainland, Halibut Bay, and the east side of Kodiak Island in that deal. So anyhow, what I want to do is this isn't an inter-island controversial issue, and this is documentation to that. I'm going to just let you guys borrow and read it. It's the borough's resolution from 94. Has all the villages, individuals, businesses, processors. They all supported the borough. And the borough at that time do something about this, because it's they're just trying to take money from us. So here, I'll hand this to you guys. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Raymond May. I think most of us here have probably been caught a little off guard, I think, in the last couple of months. The genetic study, I think, is something that stemmed this conversation. But one thing I see Cook Inlet asking the Board of Fish to do is change our management plan for Kodiak salmon. They have stocks of concern in Upper Cook Inlet, and I don't understand why they'd come after Kodiak when they haven't even addressed their own management plan for their own stocks of concern. Now, out of those stocks of concern, they have several rivers of over-escapement also. So I think they got a problem within themselves right now that I feel they should spend more energy at than fighting with us. But the other one is it's my understanding that Swampsea and ASA are working together today, kind of overlapping our meetings here, but John may be able to correct me. I didn't see an agenda. They're looking to maybe bring the two groups together and have some sort of compromise. And I don't understand. And I could be wrong. This is secondhand information. I couldn't see that in documentation. But I don't see where there is a compromise right now. And I believe this is stemmed from ASA. So those are just a couple of things I wanted to kind of bring up to you guys today. I'm sure several people are going to touch other points that I'd like to talk about, but I'll let other people speak. Thanks.
Thanks, Raymond. There actually is a Swampsea board meeting in about 20 minutes, and this issue is not on the agenda, but I did talk to the executive director, Eric O'Brien, yesterday, and I didn't hear anything about a compromise. So,
Mr. Chair, if you would please ask the speakers to sign in also so I can get their names for the record. Thank you.
Okay, any other public comment?
Hello, Burl. Al Cranny from Old Harbor. I'd just like to speak on behalf of the villages, too. I mean, what's coming forward here, we fought for, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, and it's going to be a tough one. What discourages me is the Board of Fish. I mean, you look at all the guys sitting on there, and you got three guys from Cook Inlet, two guys from the interior, and no representation from Kodiak. I hope you look really good at this and look forward to working with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to speak?
Hi, my name is Astrid Rose. I hope this is appropriate. I'm actually going to be reading a letter on behalf of my husband. He's over at the school and can't be here. So good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the Kodiak Fisheries Work Group. My name is Nate Rose, and I am a commercial salmon seiner in Kodiak. I am also part of a group called the Kodiak Seiners that is in the process of being incorporated. First and foremost, I appreciate you taking up the upcoming Upper Cook Inlet genetic study and the Board of Fish issues that will most definitely impact Kodiak. As you know, this issue is not new. There is a very similar and brutal battle that took place in the 1990s between Kodiak salmon fishermen and the Cook Inlet stakeholders. You have before you a number of documents that supported Kodiak's position on this issue before, and I believe they are equally relevant today. The Kodiak salmon fishery has large impact on the overall health, economic health of the Kodiak community and the surrounding native villages in the Kodiak archipelago. The trickle-down effect of poor salmon years can be evidenced by this last year's poor pink salmon harvest and any impingement on future salmon seasons, whether biological or regulatory, could potentially have a drastic effect on Kodiak's economy. Please consider this a letter of request for your continued monitoring and help with this issue. In anticipation of the Cook Inlet Board of Fish meeting happening in Anchorage next week, we ask that you draft a letter supporting the Kodiak area stakeholders in developing and implementing a strategy designed to defend Kodiak's historical and tradition salmon fishery. Furthermore, as the situation unfolds over the course of the upcoming weeks, we ask that you consider continuing support of the Kodiak salmon fleet with whatever resources are available, regulatory, financial, legal, and analytical through the use of your fisheries analyst. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Astrid. And I don't know that we have that letter, but if we we do have that? Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify? Okay, hearing none, we will have another opportunity at the end of the meeting. Do I have a call in? Okay, this is somebody listening. Okay. We will have another opportunity for public comment at the end of the meeting. So at this point, we've been fortunate enough to have Nick Zagalkin from the ADF&G here this morning, so I'd like to invite Nick up to give us some background on the study and from a historical perspective and through to where we are today, so we can get some idea on the science behind this and maybe perhaps some of the processes that went into this study to begin with. Oh, I'm sorry. Why don't you sit right there? I forgot. I didn't have my glasses on. Okay, now I got my glasses on. We have a fisheries analyst report. But you can sit right there since you're comfortable. Sorry about that.
Though he knows more than I do, I think. About a lot of things. this is Heather McCarty for those people that are on the network out there. I did a written report that kind of summarized much of what you've already heard from the public. And so I'm not going to go over the background and the issue and the problem, but I thought I might talk a little bit about the process. My written report is online, and it's also in the larger package that some of you may have out there. I also included in that a couple of these historic documents that were provided by CRISPA and some of the final reports from the fisheries, from the salmon working group from the late 90s. So talking about the Board of Fish process, and again, there's others here who can go into more detail, but what I was told yesterday was that, of course, as you all know, this is not formally a consideration of any proposals having to do with Kodiak, is not on the agenda for the Cook Inlet meeting. They're going to get this genetic report that you had here at the Board of Fish meeting last month, and then at the end of the meeting, they're going to have, under miscellaneous business, a discussion of whether and how to go forward with the issue. And according to the executive director of the Board of Fish, he anticipates that one of those things that could happen is the establishment of a working group of the Board of Fish. This is kind of like a subcommittee in a sense. They did it most recently on the state waters pollock issue. If you recall that, if you were involved in any of that, they appoint members from all stakeholder groups. They have several public meetings. They're staffed by Fish and Game, and they bring out all of the pertinent information during a process that could last for as long as a year. And then they make recommendations to the Board of Fish. So considering that that might happen and considering that they will be hearing the genetics report, my recommendation, as the analyst, would be that those who are advocating for the Kodiak fisheries would be helpful to be there at the beginning to hear the report and hear any questions and discussion that the board might have about the report. And then at the end of the meeting, it's a long meeting, starts on the 23rd and it goes to March 8th. On the last day, March 8th, is when they'll have the real discussion of the board about how they want to go forward. It's always helpful to talk to the members of the Board of Fish themselves, as you know. And at this particular time, it would be important for those advocates for Kodiak fisheries to be there, ready to serve on this potential working group and to sort of make themselves known to the Board of Fish at that time as interested parties. So that's just looking in the short term what how this meeting that's coming up might be addressed. Obviously, in the long term, if this does go forward, it's going to be a long road. And obviously, there's a number of reasons why the city and borough would be supportive of the stakeholders. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Heather. Okay. Now I got my glasses back on. So now, Nick, thank you for being here this morning, and we'll turn it over to you.
Can you hear me now? I guess before I begin, I tried to get the geneticist to call in. Do we have anyone online? Is Chris Habicht online? Okay, so I'll try to give a brief overview. The geneticist for the department is online, and then also I saw James Jackson, the Kodiak Area Management Biologist, come into the room. So I don't know if this is appropriate, John, or Mr. Whitten, but not really knowing the scope of questions you have, I can give sort of a brief overview, and then if you have questions that I might help kind of focus the conversation, there's different experts that might be more appropriate to answer your question. Mr. Habicht.
Yeah, Ms. Habicht, and I don't know that we can hear you. I wonder if it would be better if we call in on the other number.
Okay, I'll call in the other number.
Now we can hear you. Okay, good.
Oh, you can hear me?
Now we can, yes.
Okay, so maybe just as a kind of introduction of how we got here. For a number of years now, the department has been perfecting the tools to identify specific fish stocks through genetic markers. Probably one of the most notable studies that the department did has the acronym WASIP. It was a three-year study along the Alaska Peninsula looking at the contribution or the harvest rates of stocks in the North and South Peninsula, really kind of trying to get an idea of whether those fisheries were impacting stocks up to the north, AYK and Bristol Bay regions. There's a number of user groups involved in that. The Board of Fisheries was very keen on those results. They're very interesting. They can provide a lot of details. During the last Kodiak Board of Fisheries meeting 3 years ago, there are a number of questions that came up during the meeting about the stock composition of harvest around the island. And the board was asking the department if we knew anything about those fisheries. These were mainly questions among Kodiak fishermen. So, for example, people... fishermen in Alitak have concern about the impacts of fisheries on the west side and how many of those fish are being caught on their way down to the south end. What is the true proportion of fish bound for Chignik over in the IGVAC management area? All these questions sort of reoccur at every board meeting. Board was asking these questions. We had tagging data dating back to the 1970s. A lot of this tagging data, while is okay, a lot of the results are only based on one or two tag recoveries. It's very time-intensive sampling, and the results are suspect in a lot of cases. So there's pressure on the department to get better information. The director at the time directed the region to kind of develop a study to take a look at fisheries around the island. We decided to sample areas where there's sort of several criteria that we were looking at. One was, do we do run reconstructions for these stocks? Is it a large fishery, so we weren't going to waste time sampling some of the smaller fisheries around the island? We want to do ones where the results had a potential to inform some of the science that we were doing, run reconstruction and forecasting. So we had sort of a list of metrics that we used to focus the areas that we were sampling. We sampled for 3 years, 2014 through 2016. So this last salmon season was the last year that we sampled. And again, this was really, the impetus was really looking inward, sort of at the Kodiak fisheries. But in the results, it became quite apparent that in a number of years, Cook Inlet fish are caught in various places around the islands. It was variable, but in some years was quite high. And that caught the attention of our neighbors to the north. And they are starting to react. There's a couple areas in particular that have caught the attention, IGVAC being one. In 1 year out of the three, so 1 year it wasn't fished at all. 1 year the proportion of Cook Inlet fish was relatively low. The last year where we were actually fishing later in the year, the proportion of Cook Inlet fish was quite high. I know that a lot of the user groups in Cook Inlet are also aware of sort of the history and the discussions that the Kodiak fleet's talking about in the late 80s, which sort of informed the North Shelikof plan. And there's verbiage in the North Shelikof plan that talks about sort of traditional fishing patterns and to, maybe I should actually read it. Because I think this is a key point for you guys to consider. It says in the plan, the board intends, so there's the last statement in the first paragraph, board intends, however, to prevent a repetition of the non-traditional harvest pattern which occurred during 1988. Which document was that again? That is in the Kodiak regulations. It's 5 AAC 18.363. It's the North Shelikof Strait Sockeye Salmon Management Plan. This is the management plan that went into effect in the late 80s after the history that you've heard some of the public referencing when Cook Inlet had a fairly large return of sockeye salmon, and Kodiak also had relatively high harvest. From what I can tell, there wasn't genetic or tagging data that informed the public or the board that those were truly Cook Inlet fish, but we did age sampling and run timing work, and the assumption was that a majority of those fish that were caught in 88 were Cook Inlet bound. And so then the board put in management measures to restrict. So there's caps in place in that North Shelikof plan that limit the amount of harvest that can occur. And I guess I'm not sure what else to add unless James or Chris think I missed something important.
I'd only add one thing. This is Chris Howard calling from the Gene Conservation Lab in Anchorage. We have a full report out on this that's on the Fish and Game website. It's called Fishery Management Series 16-10. And there's some, we've tried to characterize the information in here graphically at the end of this report to make it more digestible. And there are three figures that really kind of summarize all the data in one concise way, and those are figures 22, 23, and 24. So I'd if you guys have an opportunity to look at those, that's a great way to get a handle on the overall result from this study.
Okay, Nick, if you could, maybe just for our benefit sitting up here at the diocese, if you could maybe expand on this 2014-2016 study, you know, what made 2014 unique in terms of the high escapement, and was that of sockeye escapement of intercept fish that were caught in the Kodiak area, and did that correlate to the same high level of sockeye caught in the Kenai area? So were they seeing also an equally high number of sockeye escape as well? But what was the if anything was the was there an indicator or a recognized cause of the high intercept in 2014?
James, are you there?
I might have James answer, but I think you might. So 2014, the amount of Cook Inlet fish caught in the Kodiak area was low. It's really 2015 and 16. Okay.
You want me to just jump up here?
This is on? Oh, hello. So for the record, my name is James Jackson. I'm the Kodiak Commercial Salmon Area Management Biologist. And just to be clear, the question was what made 2015 unique and why was there so much interception of potential Cook Inlet. Well, 2015 was a very large pink salmon run. And if you look at the genetic study, and Chris could probably back me up on this, and so can Nick, is the majority of the interception of Cook Inlet fish takes place during the pink salmon fishery. So that would be in July and maybe in August. And during that time frame, we open and close the majority of the area based on local pink salmon abundance, but we also have some local sockeye systems. The 2015 season was a very large pink run. So to put in perspective, 600,000 Cook Inlet fish were caught during that time frame. 37 million salmon were caught in the Kodiak area that year. So, and 33 million of those were pink salmon. So because of the way we manage the fishery, because we manage based on the local abundance, we had a lot of fishing time in July. And that's the probable cause of why we intercepted as many Cook Inlet fish as we did. Thanks.
So just to follow up to that, did so on that particular year, on the high pink year, did Kenai see a corresponding high sockeye return that year, or was it? Does anybody have an idea in terms of? So was it just an anomaly in Kodiak, or was it something that occurred throughout the fishery, throughout the region?
Mr. Chairman, I honestly don't keep track of Cook Inlet as close as I could. I would much rather somebody from Cook Inlet tell you whether they had a good run or not. It was definitely larger than it was in 2016. I know that.
Nick, I'd like to ask you, and I don't know if you're the one to ask. It might be the genetic person on the phone. Are there plans for additional or continued studies of any kind, genetic or otherwise, on this issue? Do you have the money for that, or is it something that's just this snapshot in time and not to be continued?
Let's see. These aren't inexpensive studies to do. Generally, we go for a three-year study plan and then kind of regroup and move forward. The fact that we just did one in Kodiak, the normal priority wouldn't be to refocus another study back in Kodiak. It would probably go somewhere else. I do know that because of the amount of questions that this study generated, I am getting a number of inquiries down the chain, how much it would cost, is it possible for us to go back in and sample IGVAC? But those are just questions at this point.
Oh, okay, because I know that some folks have mentioned that the IGVAC sampling was relatively small, and I don't know if the geneticist wants to speak to that, but you know, the weight that's given to that and whether it's appropriate for that particular time clip, if you will. Is it enough? That's a question for the geneticist, I believe.
So I understand there's a question for him, but I can't quite I'm having a hard time making out the words. Could you please repeat?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Okay. I was wondering if in looking at the idea of doing additional work, several people have mentioned that, in particular, the IGVAC section of the study is pretty small. You know, the sample is small, time-wise. And I was wondering if you could comment on that, whether that's enough data to draw any conclusions.
Sure. So in IGVAC, the 3 years that the study was conducted in 2014, 15, and 16, the only year, my understanding is the only year where the fishery in IGVAC was conducted in a more normal way was in 2016, and we do have samples from that single year. But I think even that year, it wasn't a the most typical year for IGVAC. The other 2 years, we have a very small sample in 2015 and nothing in 2014. And I believe that those years were, we don't have samples because there was very little or no fishing. So to add years to IGVAC would provide information for more typical years, potentially. That's what I can tell you from a genetics perspective. You know, we can do stock composition estimates. As far as in using that information or how that information would improve the management of the fisheries, that really would be back to the fish managers and researchers in the Kodiak area.
Okay, thank you. Pat, then Matt.
Right, thank you. I'm not used to pushing that button. Human nature is that people draw figures and numbers to back up what they want to push forward. And so my question is, with where we are, and this isn't a new issue, it seems like it cycles up every so often, and I'll be interested to go back and read the information from the 80s and 90s on this. So what would be the process, Nick, for pushing forward, or if the fisheries work group brings back to their respective bodies to have more samplings done and studies done, what would that process be? Because it sounds like it's all over the board, quite frankly.
So I guess there's a direct answer. I can answer you directly, and then there's sort of a spin-off to that. Because, of course, other people are drawing conclusions and moving forward on their own agenda. And so I think it might be wise for the board or the city and the borough to engage that pathway as well. And that is the board process, so making your voices known at the board. So if you you think it wise to have more information to inform the ultimate decisions, make that clear. If you want the department or want to encourage the money to flow into this study, you know, there's pressure for us to cut budgets. So letters to the legislature and the director saying, hey, we'd like this funded.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Nick, my question is kind of a spinoff of what Mayor Branson was just saying, and what I'd like to know from the Kodiak standpoint is how will these data be used by you as the managers here? Is this the genesis of this project? Was it more of an interesting research pilot project to kind of fill a gap in our data set? Or do you anticipate this being used to inform management and allocative issues because of its political nature?
The sort of the disappointing thing is that there's nothing in the results that's really going to change how we do business. Most of our management is escapement based, and so we don't see anything in our management plans that's going to be altered by these results. The other pieces that you can inform are kind of how you apportion fish back to stocks, so the run reconstruction, the forecasting. And it didn't really change our views on the world. It sort of corroborated what we were already doing. So it really didn't change anything. The allocative aspects, so IGVAC, how many of those fish are chignik bound, or how many of those fish are Cook Inlet bound, those aren't really things that the department weighs in on. They're directed to us through the board. And truthfully, some of those results, genetic results, pointed toward things that are different in the allocated plans, and the board chose not to change anything.
Yeah, thank you. That's pretty much exactly what I was thinking you were going to say. My concern, though, is with the recent decision about some of the Cook Inlet fisheries going back to federal control or going into the federal management plans in the Magnuson-Stevens Act, because some of the things that I've been reading, some of the national standards of this include optimum yield, best available science, equitable allocations, and community health. And so I'm wondering, even though this isn't necessarily going to change the way we do business down here in Kodiak, because there's that potential of the fisheries management up in Cook Inlet being held to federal standards, that might change some of the things that we're doing on the federal level, and then we'd have to abide by some of that. Could you speak to that at all?
Well, I guess maybe I should back up a little bit in saying that the Kodiak staff don't see any way to change our current harvest strategies to improve management of Kodiak stocks. I also don't see, because of the variability in the genetics, I personally do not see clear ways that you could use the results to improve management of Cook Inlet stocks. That doesn't mean that the board will view it differently, and I'm sure the constituents the user groups up in Cook Inlet see that differently. So they may make changes. I guess it's a little hard for me to speculate on what's going to happen with the federal rules. It's going through courts. It's being appealed. If the federal government takes it over, I don't even know what they'll do. They may draft a FMP. Heather might, Mrs. McCarthy might have better insight on this.
I'm going to ask Heather to weigh in when you're done.
They may close a fishery. That's a bigger gorilla.
Thanks, Nick. Heather.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Heather. Regarding the recent court case, basically the federal government has two choices as to how they might manage fisheries, salmon fisheries, while the FMP is being developed, because that's basically what they would have to do unless the decision is changed. They'd have to do a federal management plan, a fisheries management plan for salmon. In the interim, that takes 2 or 3 years through the council process. In the interim, they can choose to close the fishery or to manage it in some way that's similar to the way it's being managed now. And my understanding and expectation is that they won't close the fishery because that would be dumb. And so they probably will just have it managed as it's being managed now while the FMP is being developed. And most people expect that the federal FMP will look almost exactly like the state management that's currently in place. So in other words, the answer is it's a long process, and at the end of it, you might have the same thing you have now, or very similar.
Nick, and I've actually probably already answered the question I'm about to ask anyway, but I'll ask it, is that can you say, and this is really helping us determine where our argument or points can be, but do you feel confident or not that the study in question can stand on its own? And I think you already indicated that there's no clear way to inform or improve management, but is this study able to stand on its own in terms of impacting management decisions? Because ultimately, certainly the Kenai region is going to use this 3-year time clip as the genesis of their moving in a different direction, where we're saying this doesn't help you with your management or even the Kenai or the Kenai region with them. But so maybe you can just maybe expand on that, so we can maybe use that as see if there's something we can pull out of that to put into a letter.
I'll try. Chris might have a more eloquent answer than me. The difficulty, Mr. Whitten, is that you're right. It's a snapshot in time. It is a relatively brief snapshot. Most of the fishermen in the room and the managers realize that every year is a little different. You have different run sizes. The size of the fleet is different. People's choices of where they fish change year to year because of the price of salmon, perhaps the forecast. The patterns of fish movement change because of weather. If there's a lot of northwest or easterly winds, they might be on the mainland, they might come up the east side, they might be on the west side. Temperature also affects migration of fish. There were some years where it seemed like fish were coming from a different direction than we were used to. At the end of the day, though, we have a study that has more resolution for that time, for those 3 years, than what we had before. You have genetic data. And that is better than tagging data that dates back to the 70s. So the people that are making the decisions are going to have to weigh the trade-off between the variability in the biology, the lack of samples, a 3-year time slot, and the accuracy and the precision of genetic data versus sort of anecdotal understanding and also 20-year-old tag data, and come up with their own decisions.
What's different today that didn't exist back in the 90s when this was discussed? And does this genetic study just pretty much say the same thing that they were assuming back then? And so I'm wondering why. I guess the other question is, how do our Alaska statutes that are written today, that you referenced one of them, and I went online and downloaded a couple of them that deal with this issue, the emergency closures and the North Shelikof Strait Management Plan and the others, protect us from any actions that could be detrimental to Kodiak?
Okay, so there's a lot in that question. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. What's different today than back in the late 80s or early 90s? James or some of the other fishermen might be able to speak better to that, but lots is different. There's a lot of things different. Many of our systems were at different production levels. Karlik is a main driver on the island. I don't quite know how Karlik was behaving then compared to what it is now. The size of the same fleets, so the number of active participants is different from now to then versus then. I'm less aware, I'm less informed on this, but even elements up in Cook Inlet have changed. There's fisheries that have started since those times. The personal use fisheries up in Cook Inlet are relatively new, and those are big and have a lot of interest in them. I guess the other thing to point out is that attention that we're sort of focusing on was a specific area around Kodiak, the Shelikof, and a Fognak, and the board did take an action. There's caps. The areas that we're talking about now aren't the same areas. I mean, there's proximity, but we didn't even sample the North Shelikof as part of the genetic study. So if you look back in time at those documents talking about the 90s, they made inferences about the contribution of Cook Inlet stocks based on run timing and age composition, and I didn't read them very thoroughly, but it appears that they made assumptions of very high rates of Cook Inlet fish, much higher than what we're estimating in some of the genetic samples in these other areas. So I don't know if I answered. Oh, then you asked about regulations. I guess two other regulations you might look at. And I could get, I don't know the regulation numbers off the top of my head. One is there's a regulation talking about mixed stock fisheries. So the board has guidance on mixed stock fisheries. And then the board also has guidance on traditional fisheries, so fisheries that are in traditional areas and sort of maintaining the traditional harvest of fish.
Thank you, and this kind of goes along with some of the other discussions. Going forward, if there is no genetic research done, say in the next 3 or 4 years, what tools do you have to determine what the Cook Inlet component of any particular sample is? You talked about tagging studies that go back to the 60s, 70s, 69, I think, and you talked about run timing and age composition being used and inferred from to determine Cook Inlet percentages. Are those the only tools you have? It sounds like it.
Yes. It would be very difficult to tell at any moment in time what fish you're catching. The only way I could conceivably see you doing that is if you had in-season genetics, because truthfully, even year to year, the timing of fish changes. You could get an average run timing, but then you'd miss. And so if you had a, I guess that's how I struggle, how you the Cook Inlet plans will react to this to change it, but Even if you have in-season genetics, you'll be responding after you have the answer.
I have just a quick question for you. Raymond may mention that, you know, Coconut has issues of their own management plan, and I don't expect you to be familiar with that, but do you have, can you point us in a direction as to what their specific issues are, so to see if there's some way we can at least investigate that, see if there's anything there for us?
I don't feel comfortable answering that. I don't know.
Oh yeah. So Ms. Jeffrey is here, and so maybe, and she's going to be called on. Maybe she can give us a handle on what the board's take on that is, or your understanding, if you might know it at a later time.
Thanks. I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. So, but we're here to gather facts as much as we can. I appreciate you being here. We're actually doing okay for time. If there's no other specific questions, I'd like to, if anybody from the audience wants to come up and ask the questions specific to the study, and if Nick, if you wouldn't mind and be available, then we'll take questions. But if you have a specific question for Nick, please come up and sign in and do the same thing. But keep it specific to the study. Thank you.
Raymond Magan. Nick, can you enlighten us on what that three-year study costs the department to do a three-year study for your genetic study?
Chris, do you have that number offhand?
Yeah, I think, well, I've got the number for our lab. I think our lab was around $600,000 for this three-year study. But that does not include the sample collections in the field.
So it was, my ballpark guess is it probably wasn't quite a million, but, you know, 800.
Hello, Nick. Yeah, I was just wondering, I know you did
Al, can you state your name for the record, please?
Al Craddy.
Thank you.
Old Harbor. I know you did these studies in Alitac. I was just wondering, I've been fishing Alitac, and we haven't caught no amount of coconut fish there. Are them coming in from other tenders from different areas or something? I'm concerned about, you know, because you know as well as I do, I fish Alitac a lot, and there hasn't been any coconut numbers down there.
The way we did the sampling for the study is we stationed samplers at processing facilities. So we had a crew in town, a crew in Larson Bay, and a crew in Alitac. They were made aware. So we had these temporal strata and geographic areas that we wanted to sample. So they were targeting their samples from tender deliveries that were reporting to bring in harvest from those areas. It's always possible that there is misreporting, but you know, we do our best to try to ground truth that, and we're taking samples from over multiple deliveries, and the chance of that is always there, but I think it, we do our best to minimize it.
Thank you.
Chris Burns. It's my understanding there isn't going to be any Westward staff when this genetic study is presented in Anchorage, but there will be Cook Inlet management staff, the entire contingency of the sport fish and Uceda and the set netters there. And basically, I can see this genetic study be like, if there isn't anyone for a board member to ask questions to from Kodiak about the issues you've addressed about local management and the a mixing of local stocks in this time period when they pass through. These genetic samples are all done in time periods. There were three time periods. The middle time period is the heart of our pink salmon fishery. So in that middle time period, the genetic study was the when the, there was this big marker of Cook Inlet fish, or big or normal or whatever it is. That's the only time. It wasn't on the June to July 6th. It wasn't on the late run. So the problem is there won't be anybody to, from ADF&G there to say, okay, we did this study. Why did we do it? And just like you presented to us just now. And I think that that would really be a bad thing for us. I know you can't go up and defend us as fishermen up there, but we're just going to be, this whole thing is going to be like kill Hillary at a Trump rally or something. It'll be bad. It'll be like throwing gasoline on a fire. If there isn't someone from Kodiak there, Kodiak staff, to answer questions from a board member, if there's a friendly board member in the on the board, that's if there is one. I suggest that somebody from the Westwood region represent Kodiak at that meeting.
Thank you, Chris. Just a last question so we can move on, so thank you.
Oliver Holm, first off, start by pointing out a mistake in the report, and one of the contributors of the saltery stock was left out of the report, and it's Gatoy Bay Hatchery. This might explain some of the higher-than-expected saltery stock contribution. But I wonder if you could explain the role of Bayesian mathematics used in this report, because I'm just vaguely familiar with that, and I'm not sure why what role that plays in the results of the report.
Are you still on the line, Chris?
I am, but I had a really hard time hearing that question.
So Mr. Holm was asking about the statistical methods and specifically why we use Bayesian statistics for the mixed stock analysis.
Okay. So the methodologies that we use are, as you say, Bayesian. And what that means is that the basic concept behind this is that we have a baseline where we have the populations sort of fingerprinted. So we know what allele frequencies are. These are genes, the proportion of genes you see a certain kind in one population versus another. So we have these allele frequencies that are characterized for populations. And then we take a mixture, a sample taken from the fishery, and we try, the Bayes program tries to figure out what proportion of those fish would best explain the frequencies that we see in that sample. And that's what we report. So we don't actually take a fish and say, where does this fish belong? We take the entire mixture at once and say, what proportions would best explain this sample? And that methodology gives us much more accurate estimates of the stock composition. So that's why we use this Bayesian methodology, which is pretty much the standard used for mixed stock analyses throughout the community that uses these kinds of technologies. I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, that helps. I guess I was thought it was important to understand some of the basis of how these numbers were come up with, because in the I think it was the late 80s, early 90s, there the scale sample analysis was used in the southwest of Frontenac and the North Shelikof area to determine contributions of Cook Inlet fish. And it turns out when you look into that pretty really closely, there are some serious problems with that methodology. So, well, thank you for the explanation.
Thank you.
Yeah, so back in the early 90s when I first started working, we used more traditional statistics, and those have fallen out of favor because the Bayesian methodologies have proven to be better at estimating stock compositions. So our lab, a lot of other labs, have done a lot of work looking at all these different methodologies, and this is the one that basically everybody's using today. So there have been some fairly major improvements with this Bayesian methodology.
Thank you. Kyle has a question, then we're going to take a quick five-minute break.
Do the managers see that it's practical to somehow limit the fishery without causing a problem of over-escapement here in Kodiak? And some of those, I'm sure that they've been thoughtful of that, and the Board of Fish may be, but how can we weed out Cook Inlet-bound fish if that becomes the issue without impacting our ecosystems here?
I'll give a real high-level response, and then maybe James can follow up with some detail. Very difficult to achieve both. If you limit the pink salmon fishery, you potentially suffer quality in fish, and you will potentially over-escape. So someone's going to have to make a choice.
You are listening to KMXD Kodiak 100.1 FM.
This is James Jackson again, Kodiak commercial salmon management biologist. So these management plans have evolved over the last 40 years, and they work really well. So any change, like Nick says, that you make to any of these management plans, I can't really speak exactly how the board or, you know, some user group would want to change the plan. We'll make it more difficult for us to achieve both our sockeye and our pink salmon escapement goals. That's not to say that it can't be done. An important point to bring up is the pink salmon odd year escapement goal. We usually like to shoot for about 5 million pink salmon in the streams. That's aerial survey wise, so it's actually a different number, but the general number is 5 million. And it's important to point out that in 2015, when we caught that large number of Cook Inlet fish, we harvested in July on around 7 or 8 million pink salmon. So anytime you would limit that, our ability to have a fishery opening, you're going to end up getting more of those fish in the streams. There's more than just inter-area allocation issues that go along with this as well. A large number of the terminal fisheries in Kodiak, both for pink salmon and sockeye, are seine only. So if you had any kind of mandatory closures on the west side, you would also have inter-area and by gear allocation issues. In other words, if you had mandatory closures, say, in the central section, a lot of the pink salmon and sockeye salmon that are local could potentially also be allocated to seine-only areas. So not only would you be sending fish to Cook Inlet, but you would also allocate within gear groups. And in general, that makes managing difficult as well. The department's stance will always be that, and we're going to be neutral in all the allocative aspects, but the department's stance is always going to be that these management plans evolved over a long period of time and the current plan works well.